I saw the angel on the marble and carved until I set him free, said the brilliant Renaissance artist, Michelangelo. Sounds simple enough, right? The part frequently overlooked is the lengths to which the famous sculptor would go to find just the right piece of marble for his project. You know, the one with the angel in it. One story has Michelangelo climbing Mount Altissimo in Tuscany for the marble of his dreams. Not unlike the value-add developer looking for the deal of his dreams, wouldn't you say? Here's where the story gets really good. Michelangelo's most notable work, the Statue of David, was a renovation, a value-add, you could say. The project had already been started by another sculptor, Antonio Rossellino. Rossellino had barely started one of David's legs when he abandoned the project based on poor quality of marble. A quarter of a century later, in walks Michelangelo, looking for a value-add opportunity, or something like that. The young artist was given 2 years to complete the work. Isn't that how it always goes? The semi-chiseled block sat there for 25 years, and suddenly they're on a deadline. Even with mediocre marble, Michelangelo extracted what would be known through the ages as some of the artist's best work. It was later described as bringing back to life one who was dead. And the rest is history. Today, I am delighted to introduce Andrew Chavin, CEO of Princeton Properties out of Lowell, Massachusetts. Princeton is privately held and owns and manages over 7,000 units across Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine. They also specialize in rehabilitating properties set aside by other operators. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Linda, it's a pleasure to be here, and what a unique and terrific introduction.
Thank you. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Andrew.
Sure. I've been in this business for quite a long time, dating all the way back to being a freshman in college and being an intern at General Investment and Development. And my parents were both, interestingly enough, in the real estate business. They both converted buildings to condominiums. And I remember being in seventh and eighth grade and asking them, well, why would you sell these assets? Why would you sell these units as condominiums when you're going to get paid once, when if you held them, you're going to have them for a long period of time? Sort of a childish answer that you got from a 13-year-old likely at the time. But there's a germ of truth in there. There's sort of a thread of truth about this. And I ended up in this business, not by accident, but really purposely. I spent 4 years as an intern at General Investment and then came out and shortly after college ended up here. And I've been at Princeton the great majority of my professional life, been here 28 years and 26 as CEO. And I've always thought that we are tremendously fortunate to be in a business like this where people talk about food, clothing, and shelter. The shelter piece of it is something that even through this pandemic, we have been extremely fortunate to be in a business that and have a product that people need and want. Whether that is type A or type B assets, they are certainly areas that people absolutely need through a pandemic. So there are many people out there that are not as fortunate, that really, truly, their businesses and their business plan made a lot of sense, but for the pandemic. We've been incredibly fortunate through the pandemic to be in this particular business.
Andrew, Michelangelo climbed Mount Altissimo. You've stayed in England. How has this geographic concentration worked out through the COVID pandemic?
Having most of our apartment homes so close, within 90 minutes, frankly, of our corporate office, has really held us in good stead through the COVID pandemic. The long-term vision of Princeton Properties, both myself and the founder of the company, Jim Herscott, has really been a long-term hold. And the ability to own these assets over a long period of time and really treat them almost as our children since 1973, has really played into the COVID pandemic in a way that we could not have expected. Our senior management has been able to go out and touch and feel the product in a way that I think a lot of other folks who are not as geographically concentrated would be. And so when we're able to say to our investors, to our debt lenders, and to ourselves and our teammates, hey, we really care. We're not only putting our money where our mouth is, but we're putting our feet there as well. And so having everything within 90 minutes, I can tell you I've been out there. I can tell you when colleagues have become ill, all of us to a one have gone out and actually helped. I actually covered an office for a day. I'm not sure my colleagues would ever want me to do that again. But there are times when you have to roll up your sleeves and do those kinds of things. So the geography has certainly helped us.
Well, you have dabbled in the South, specifically a couple properties in Georgia. Why the pullback?
So the properties in Georgia were a real opportunistic venture that we had with an equity lender that we've known for some time. There's an old saying that when you have one loan, the bank owns you. When you have four loans, you own the bank. And in this particular case, this was a very large portfolio, over 1,200 apartment homes. And so hiring someone locally to take care of such a relatively enormous task really was not something that they wanted to turn over to strangers. So they turned to us, and we were able to mobilize, and we ended up in a place in Norcross, Georgia, where we had never been before. But the issue really wasn't about locale there. It was really trying to rehabilitate something that was worth almost half of what had originally been valued at. So we worked through that program. We were able to ride the wave back up. An awful lot of elbow grease, a lot of sort of real, what I'll call blood and guts property management, making sure that everyone respected their neighbor, respected the lease, respected everything about the process, which I'm not sure had happened in the past. And so we brought our sort of unique brand of property management there, and we were able to achieve a really, really solid end result for the equity owner. And it certainly was profitable for us as well. We've done a few other things in Florida. We've been in the East Coast of Florida several times where many of our investors were. But we found that sticking to our knitting up here, this is where the opportunities really come to life for us. Much of real estate is not only location, 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 but there's another axiom that I like as well. It's who you know. And the debt lenders know us, the equity lenders know us, the zoning boards, the planning boards, the conservation commissions know us, and there's a level of built-in credibility at this point. And so we're really sticking to our knitting these days.
I love your vernacular on that. Respect the lease. Furnished apartments have been a pillar of your business. How has that held up through 2020, and what are the prospects for 2021?
Furnished corporate apartments were the history, if you will, or the beginning of Princeton Properties. Digital and Wang Computers, two enormous companies in New England, at times had entire apartment communities net leased that were 100% furnished right down to the potato peeler and the corkscrew for a period of time. And then as those companies became fragmented and ultimately, sort of moved into oblivion, many of their offshoots became our clients. And so instead of having two large clients with hundreds of units, we had hundreds of clients with hundreds of units. And that has pulled itself back. In 2008, when the financial crisis hit, people stopped traveling quite a bit. September 11th had quite a bit to do with that. So the furnished business has had some body blows over time. It'll be interesting to see what happens after the pandemic with Zoom and Microsoft Teams. Will people believe that that is enough to establish corporate culture, or will people really need to be face-to-face? And the furnished corporate business is really that. It is really, some of it is people between homes, but the majority of it truly is corporate travel. And having to train or become a trainer in a different place. And we'll see just how much of that comes back. we use the furnished business a lot in our new construction product, or if we are reorienting or rehabilitating an apartment community, where we're not working against a tightened availability. So if we, you know, in a normal situation, we would say, what is our vacancy rate going to look like if we have people coming in furnished? We might have availability on the beginning and the end of that, and that has to look at, we have to look at that in terms of yield. When you have a new construction community or you have a rehabilitated community where you're moving building by building or section by section, we're really not fighting against an occupancy level. We're leasing up or we're moving towards something. So there really is no opportunity cost, I guess is the best way to phrase it. So we use it quite often in those situations.
Like Michelangelo and the Statue of David, Princeton's strength is rehabilitating neglected properties. This used to be called urban renewal, and it was generally welcomed. Now it is called gentrification, and it is widely demonized. How do you overcome the plight of a developer?
It's a really good question, Linda, and it is one that really site specification, where we actually choose to be, has quite a bit to do with how we implement this sort of urban gentrification or movement, and you know how people really respond to that. First and foremost, I think any responsible developer doesn't, won't, shouldn't be walking into a community saying, you know, you're going to be out of here soon, pal, and et cetera. I don't believe that responsible developers work in that fashion. They, on the other hand, they do see a diamond in the rough in many cases where location, location, location is important, very important, and the asset is likely underutilized. So I think there's a balance. Many of our communities, Lowell, Massachusetts, Lawrence, Massachusetts, Worcester, Nashua, these are larger cities, but we're choosing suburban locations, if you will, within urban centers or urban zip codes. And so the idea of gentrification, people generally tend to think of large cities and moving sort of city blocks. We're taking, you know, 200, 300, 400 unit apartment communities that are in themselves their own little island. Many of them, because of what we see as an opportunity, means that maybe the resident profile there has not been up to what the neighborhood might want or what the local government might want. So we generally tend to find that when we're asked the question that you asked, our response has been, we haven't really seen too much of that in what I'll call the suburbs of the cities. We have found government coming to us, partnering with us, asking us to do more. They want the very best that they can possibly have. Some cynics might say they want that for tax-based purposes. I like to think that they're doing it because they want the very best community that we can have. A lot of our colleagues have gone in and in these situations and sort of looked at an improvement program a little differently than maybe we do. We look at the improvement program as what can this particular area afford and no more. We're long-term holders, and so we have a second and third bite at the apple down the road through refinancing. So we tend not to throw the kitchen sink, if you will, even at the kitchens. We might be doing cabinets and countertops and other things, but we also do them over a longer period of time, and we look at the cycle not as being one bite at the apple, but as two or three.
So I can make an assumption, but how are the rehab residents handled?
Carefully, I think is a cautious answer. But I think we have to be very honest with them. Over time, the community is likely to change. And if they do respect the lease and they do respect their neighbor, there will be a place for them there. Real estate still has a cash flow component to it, especially during rehab. And a developer has to be really cautious about that. So we want them to be there for as long as it makes sense for them to be there. And if it makes sense for them to pick up and move to the next building that already has new kitchens, new baths, new hallways, new roofs, et cetera, well, that's wonderful. If over time the community doesn't work for them any longer, that's okay too. But I think the goal here is not to come in with a sort of a cloud of dust and teams after teams after teams of people. I think we try and do it in a very humanistic way. Again, because we're so geographically concentrated, our reputation is everything. And the last thing we want, especially in this day and age of social media, is people coming in and saying, those guys did this or those guys did that, whether it's right or wrong. We want to treat everyone well at the beginning. We want to explain what the program looks like. And generally, because the program does take a very long period of time, this is not usually something that's done in a month or a year. It's done over 2 to 3 years. Generally, we're able to accommodate most everyone.
That's great. It gives them time to adjust.
It gives them time to adjust. It gives the community time to adjust. No one's coming in and saying, you have 30 days and you need to pack. We've never done that. And I don't know of any responsible developers who do that.
True. The Biden administration is expected to promote energy efficiency in older buildings, Andrew. Do you typically include efficiency upgrades in your rehabs? How difficult is it to add them?
It's difficult if you have a short-term mentality. So if this is a fix it up and sell it mentality, it makes it very difficult to justify in your pro forma that you're going to make energy efficient upgrades, because unless there are significant grants out there, which there are, then it really just isn't going to show in your bottom line relatively quickly. That's really the antithesis of what Princeton Properties is all about. We still have the very first 24 apartment home building that we purchased in 1973. We still have thousands of units that we've had from the 70s and 80s. And we have been very fortunate to have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the Federal Home Loan Banks as, if you will, debt partners. And that's been an enormous advantage. And our company's underpinning really has been to hold and to refinance and create these as communities and have them for long, long periods of time. So to the energy efficiency point, it only makes sense if you're going to hold them for decades to make sure that they're done properly. Many of these buildings do not have separate meters. We pay for the heat and hot water. It's still in a lot of these cases where you've got a central boiler in a 24 or 30 unit garden style, 2.5-story building. And so those energy efficiencies are really crucial to us. It's not a conservation measure where you can say, well, to the resident, well, you're paying the bill now, and all of a sudden you're going to see a 30% change in behavior. We have to make those changes, and it starts with insulation and those kinds of things. But to a great extent, many of these buildings just weren't built properly in the 70s and 80s, and you hear about ice dams, and you hear about these terrible leaks and problems. So we look at that first. We look at the venting of the roofs. We look at the insulation, of course. We look at making sure we've got aluminum fascia wrap around the outside of the buildings. We do everything that we can to make sure that the buildings are going to be watertight first, and then we never really have much of a problem from there. In terms of the rest of the energy efficiencies, water conservation measures are a huge deal as well as energy. And so those are the two things we really sort of focus on. But we really do look at the long term. And if you're going to own the building for decades, you really want to make it as energy efficient as possible.
Brilliant. So your properties are not submetered, or?
So the newer ones are. And there are certain markets that we have. For instance, in New Hampshire, we can go ahead and take a RUBS system where it takes an allocated percentage. That's not allowed in Massachusetts. So knowing where you are and knowing what you can and ultimately might be able to do with the asset is critical. So in Massachusetts, we can't. In New Hampshire, we can. There are some circumstances in Massachusetts after the next resident comes in that there are opportunities for additional billings. But at 30,000 feet, you really have to sort of know where you are. And in Massachusetts, more than anything else, we've got to be extremely conscious of energy efficiency.
Right. City councils and planning boards seem to be a favorite destination spot for you, Andrew. Is it hard to gain acceptance for building new projects in established areas, or is it just your winning personality?
I hope it's a little of both. I will say that it really has nothing to do with my personality, but it does have an awful lot to do with the Princeton team and the relationships that they have. We are hyper local, if you will, in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine. All of our assets are within 90 minutes of our corporate headquarters at the present time. And so the development team, the acquisitions team, these folks know an awful lot of people, whether they're planning boards or conservation commission members, zoning board of appeals members, depending on what we're attempting to do. And really, truly critical that they have a level of trust. It's not just the company's reputation, it's the reputation of each of the individuals that are appearing before those boards. And so you want to make sure that everything that you've done and everything that they might ask you about, you certainly have fulfilled your word. And I think that's held us in good stead here for the 50 years that Princeton's been in business and the 28 years that I've been fortunate enough to be here. I will also say that it's really not important to most people what you, the developer, are going to get out of this. I think too many developers look and they put these very, very wonderful pictures and architectural renderings before these boards and say, look what we're going to do. And I really, we look at it sort of the opposite way. We look at it a bit inside out. They want to know what this is going to do for their community long term. I don't think they really are anywhere near as focused on what it's going to do for Princeton properties. They want to know what it's going to do to or for their community. And so we go in at the very beginning and find out what is most important to them. A few examples. One of the newer communities that we had, we were able to get 77% voter support at town meeting and to get the local abutters group to be our spokesperson. Linda, I call it the enemy of my enemy is my friend. In this case, the enemy was a nameless, faceless shopping center developer and supermarket where you had $750,000 homes across the street. And the last thing they wanted was this 24/7 lighting and lots of concentrated traffic all day long. We determined what they really wanted was a traffic light and what they really wanted was a bus stop. And so we were able to promise them both of those things. And by doing both of those things, the enemy of my enemy became my friend. Normally, they don't want residential development. Here, residential development became significantly more important than the shopping center. And so that became critical. In other cases, we use a program here in Massachusetts called MassWorks. MassWorks is a program that allows for public-private partnership where the Commonwealth sets aside money for projects that are important to the community. So we walked into this particular community and said, what is most important to you? Not what's most important to our project, but what's most important to you? And a half a mile of sewer line later and $1 million culvert became almost a $2.9 million MassWorks grant to support our apartment community. If we had walked in there and said, look at these pretty pictures, well, that's wonderful, but those are a dime a dozen. Look at these pretty pictures, and by the way, we might be able to bring with us a half a mile of sewer line and $1 million culvert, which is your highest cost deferred maintenance project for your Department of Public Works. By doing that homework, we have much more credibility before these zoning boards and planning boards and conservation commissions, and we align our interests with theirs instead of this typical not in my backyard attitude. Going in without some sort of a plan is something that would just be something we could never support.
It's cuts to the heart of a true salesperson. Find the value, find the objection, and diffuse it.
Find a niche and fill it.
Absolutely. Well, that's all the time we have today. Thank you for sharing your insights with us, Andrew. Real exciting show.
I'm happy to have been here, Linda. Thank you for having me.
As we gaze upon the final product, whether Michelangelo's Statue of David or Andrew Chapin's new apartment value add rehab, few really understand the time, energy, and life's work that go into that one brilliant moment of completion. That is the moment when the resident calls it home. Like the artist himself, Andrew, you see the potential and start carving until you've freed the home within. Andrew, thank you for joining us and making beautiful housing where others dare not to go. I'm Linda Hoffman. Watch us for our next exciting episode of NAHB Power Hitters.